Hello? Oh. Hello, and welcome to Morning Energy Live. I'm your host, Andrew Gillick, and with me today is Rachel Perumuth, the Chief Strategy Officer at Enersponse. As many of you know, the sleepy power industry is suddenly very popular right now, as demand's growing in earnest for like the first time in 2 decades. There are a lot of ways in which we can all meet this demand, but one of the solutions many folks don't always focus on is demand response. We've come a long way from utilities calling you up and saying, "Hey, please shut the lights off." I think today we use computers and maybe some of that AI stuff to control it. But really looking forward to the discussion today on the state of the power markets and how we're going to meet the growing demands. Rachel, welcome to the show. All
Thanks for having me.
right. Before we get started on the topics at hand, I have a few questions that I want to ask you so the audience can get to know you a little bit better. All right. Okay. Very important questions. All right, so Rachel, what was the first concert you ever went to?
Jimmy Buffett.
Ah, that sounds like fun.
It was a
As
blast.
a kid, as a you know, like what point in your life did you nice.
Teenager, so
All right.
yes, so with a bunch of friends, even yes,
Wow, your parents were definitely like in the parking lot making sure it was all okay. All right, next question. Beach or mountains? Now, mind you, it's a year-round commitment, not seasonal.
I just recently moved to LA, so I feel like I'm fully committed to the beach.
That does not give you a lot of choice, but okay, you can always drive to the mountains for a visit, but I guess here you are in the beach. All right, next. Have you been to more countries or states?
42 states, so
Wow. Any
countries are up there, but not that many.
good ones that you haven't gone to? Like,
Oh, I haven't been to Alaska yet. It is my
oh.
highest priority, yes.
It seems like you could go visit the Willow Project. Tell us how it's going. Conoco's keep an eye on there. Thanks. All right, next, what is your favorite color of hydrogen?
So my heart says green or pink. But my business strategy says, let's go blue.
Blue. Oh, and I'm sure there's another reason why you want to say go blue, but we can save that for later in the discussion. All right, now the one that is most important to me, this question: what is the best sandwich?
Had a lot of internal debate on this one, but I'm gonna go with a classic PB&J. It just gets it done.
Wow, all right. I like it. You're not the first one to give us that answer, so I'll start keeping track. Thank you very much. That was great. All right, now before we get down to business, please maybe just tell the audience a little bit about how you've gotten to where you are today in the energy business.
Yeah, so I've been in the power side of energy my whole career. I started in wind in the early 2000s, but I found load flexibility and distributed energy during my time at Duke Energy. They were working on expanding their customer offerings, and I found that really interesting and moved to the deregulated side of the business under Jim Rogers to help try to start a DG business for them. From there, I spent some time at ENGIE working on battery energy storage, microgrids, and EV infrastructure most recently, before joining Enersponse and our effort to bring distributed energy resources into market.
Perfect. All right, great. All right, so maybe now you can explain what just happened in the power world these last I don't know, 6 months, 12 months, or what? Yeah, what's happened over the last year to get us to this point, and how should we think about what's happening right now?
Yeah, so in our world, it's almost like it's a explosion of load growth. I think it's relative. We're not talking 100% growth, but we're talking moving from 0.5% to 4.5%, 5% a year to 1 to 2% a year growth. I think the forecast right now from EIA is 4.7% over the next 5 years. This is just a drastic change for our industry. It's not something that we've seen since electrification of, rural areas since we brought on air conditioning. Computers, we thought were going to have this impact in the 90s, did not happen. This is really a big change for us as we think about this.
Okay, and so massive load growth. The question that always follows me or other folks, the grid. We have this grid. It's aging. We hear a lot about how generation mix in the grid has evolved over the last few years, even though load growth has remained or very low and demand's pretty stagnant. So you know, renewables are growing. Coal is getting retired, all that kind of stuff. But we also hear about how long it's taking to get new generation online, right? And how long the queues are. And so I guess a couple of questions on this. How have things changed on the grid in the last decade due to renewables growth? And, you know, a subsequent question, will we be able to meet this growing demand, whether it's through traditional or thermal energy or renewable energy?
Yeah, so you know, there's a number of drivers that are kind of coming that are colluding to make this a fun challenge for grid operators. You have a lot of policy that's being put in place, both at the federal level with the CHIPS Act, the IRA, which have added new manufacturing capacity. You have technological innovations with things like AI and decreasing costs of production on the renewable side, whether that's wind, solar, or batteries. And then you have social things like the goals around decarbonization around the U.S., whether that's local, state, or federal. So you have a number of different initiatives that are kind of driving the market. So I looked at some information to just try to put it all in context. Renewables have grown since 2000 from 0.2% of our production to 14%, just wind and solar alone.
And that's U.S.
That's U.S. That's domestic.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And to your point about renewables, even further, 77% of all capacity that came online last year was either wind, solar, or batteries. So that's capacity. We know capacity factors for wind and solar are lower than a gas plant, right? But it just shows you that there has been a sea shift in where that capital is being allocated currently. In terms of that growth, you know, at the same time, it's not that gas doesn't have a large role to play. It's doubled its capacity over the last 20 years, where it's the coal that's declining. So gas is actually replacing coal. Gas is more flexible than coal, so that renewables coming on has actually had a good partner in some of its production and generation. Helping provide some of that base load or firm capacity, depending on your part of the industry and how you like to talk about it.
Got it. So like the gas has replaced the coal, but hasn't really grown over those two. And the growth is being met by the renewables. Is that a way to think about demand growth?
Yeah. The new extra capacity is coming from renewables.
Okay, and so if this is the trend that we've been seeing recently, right, where the extra capacity is renewable, how are we going to meet this growing demand, which is now a lot faster than we thought? Can we still do it this way? Or, like, do we have to look back to some of the more traditional methods of power gen?
Yeah, I think it's honestly, I wish that there was a silver bullet, but it is what we say in the industry, a buckshot approach, right? We're going to need a little bit of everything. It also depends on if you're talking about the short term and the near term versus the midterm or long term, what technologies are going to be available. There are some, you know, there's always the fun conversations about, you know, small modular nuclear reactors or geothermal, but those technologies are really on the early stage of the learning curves and implementation, commercial implementation. So we really are looking at CTs for peak, we're looking at CCs for kind of firmer production with 40 to 60%, you know, annual run times, and then you're going to continue to see a lot of solar and storage. Wind has actually kind of flattened off some. We're not seeing year-over-year increases in capacity there, and a lot of that has to do with transmission. So I don't know how much you want to get into the transmission fund of our 10-year queues. Given that most of my time I think about load, But it is a major factor in figuring out how we get this extra generation online and delivered to the load zones of where this growth is happening.
Got it. Well, and I think maybe a follow-up question to that is regionally, like are the challenges of meeting demand growth different by region, like California versus Texas versus the Northeast? I mean, I know there's different ISOs, different kind of mandates state by state. How should we think about the regions meeting that demand?
I think that's exactly the way to think about it, because it is definitely different dynamics affecting the different regions. So if you read the filings in California or New York, you hear a lot about electrification. Their prices tend to be a little bit higher, so we're not seeing some of the big manufacturing or data centers going into those areas because they're looking for lower prices. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to see the load growth in those areas. It's just coming from some of their decarbonization policies, where they're trying to transition to electric vehicles or to their residential to heat pumps or the manufacturing that they do have to try to transition some of that into electricity power generation rather than gas. Whereas in MISO or Texas or the Southeast, that's where you're seeing these large data centers, and that's in the near term where we see the load really growing. That's what's driving a restatement of EIA forecasts. I think just in the last 2 years, it went from 2.6 to 4.7% increase for the 5-year forecast for load. So, and that increase is being driven by even higher numbers in those areas.
Okay, so let's talk about those drivers. Like you've said data centers a couple of times. Like, is it obvious where the growth is coming from? Is it commercial and industrial? Is it resi? Is it EVs? Is it just data centers? Is it a little of everything? Like I feel like until we heard the word data center, this wasn't something talked about at cocktail parties.
That is fair. So I do want to break down data centers into a couple of different categories. And I do want to give credit to
Before we go right to data center, but is before we get, is that the driver really? Is that?
In the near term, in the next 2 to 3 years, yes, that is where we're seeing the majority of that happening. I have some, depending on the region, in these particular regions where they're going in, that's where we're seeing it. So yes, electrification is driving it, but you're adding, 20 kW per home for an EV charger. You're adding maybe a couple megawatts for a long distance truck that is electrifying. Heat pumps are, so you're adding tens and hundreds of kWs on the residential and CNI side. You're adding, talking about tens and hundreds of megawatts on the data centers.
Okay. Yeah. So tell us about the data center differences.
Yeah. So there's kind of three primary categories for data centers. You have those that are providing our streaming and our social media. They are 24/7. They need to be up and going because they are on demand. Those are an area that is an important part of our economy and growth, but is really difficult on the energy side. What's more interesting for me are the two others, which are dispatchable batch processing, those that can take a task and schedule it, because that means I have some flexibility, and then the world of crypto. So if you actually look at the quote data centers that are going into Texas, like 60% of them are crypto in ERCOT. That are in the queue. So that they are energy conversion devices products, right? So that gives me a lot of flexibility. If prices are high, I can have them reduce their load. I can have them shut down. So it's a very different than, hey, I need to be up 24/7 and delivering in milliseconds my product. So those are kind of the different categories. Data centers are only about, the data centers that I mentioned are only about 6%. The true, what we think of as a data center supporting the GAFAM world, that's about 6% of the growth that we're seeing in ERCOT in the queue.
Got it. Okay. So I guess then as we think about, all this new demand that's coming from data centers mostly and other sources, and we've mentioned wind and solar and other, thermal new build to help address this. But we haven't talked about demand response yet. So let's talk about that. That's what EndResponse does. What did it mean 20 years ago, demand response, and what does it mean today? Like, so we set maybe a baseline for.
I wish I could say that your joke at the opening around a utility calling someone to have their turn their lights off was inaccurate, but we did start as an industry out of interruptible tariffs, where the utility would call their largest customers on the phone, when we had landlines with cords, and have them manually go and turn their machinery off. That was the kind of advent of this concept of flexible load. We also had one-way communication devices where we would literally people shut off people's HVAC and hot water heaters on the residential side. We didn't know what happened for a month or whenever the data was pulled, by a meter reader. And we've come a long ways from that. So at this point, we receive an open signal from the utility using an open protocol ABR. We then translate that within our system through an API to building automation or facilities, different facility programs like SCADA. So we can now automate a signal within seconds from the utility all the way to the machinery themselves, and that's a big transformation. At the same time, we are able to see that reduction in real time on the through utility meter data. So we know what's happening, we can verify that it's happening. It's a totally different story than waiting, a month to get the bill to find out whether anything happened or not.
So today you can figure out real time based on the software, and what it's doing, how much of an impact it's having on the grid, depending on where you are. Got it. So yeah.
One of the biggest evolutions for us has been the telecommunications industry. Being able to have fast internet actually has been one of the solution sets that has really helped bring us forward.
Got it. So where can demand response be most impactful? Like, is it with renewables? Is it with that data center you gave me an example of? Like, what are your where do you see the biggest area for your company to sort of penetrate today?
Yeah, so EndResponse is focused on commercial and industrial customers. We work with everything from small beauty chains with a couple kW of reduction that we're able to manage because of our software to multi-megawatt sites that have large pumping loads that or and water districts. We actually work with oil and gas, both midstream and downstream. To help them reduce when prices are high, and they're able to do that depending on the obviously the price of their production at that point. It is sensitive to the market, but we have a lot of there's a number of those players that are in this market as well. I think one of the things to think about is on the data center side, if you need 24/7, you already have solar, you have batteries, you have generators on site, you have UPS, like staying up and being on is very important to you. Demand response, maybe if you can use the generators, depending on the market, you have some flexibility to participate. But for the most part, we don't see the quote traditional the traditional data centers participating. It's those that are in those other categories of batch processing or crypto that we see and that we're engaging with as customers.
So, like,
I was looking at
do you even
the.
care what? Oh, yeah, go ahead. You were looking at. I was going to ask,
I was
what
just looking
kind of.
at.
Yeah, sorry.
There's a delay. I apologize.
Yeah. So I was going to say, do you care what kind of power is being added to the grid? Or for you, it doesn't matter because you sort of have an ability to take advantage of whatever it is.
Yeah, we are indifferent to the generation mix. The one thing I'll say about renewables is when we do see negative pricing, we can actually increase load. I mean, when we talk about load flexibility, the history has always been focused on reduction during peak. But the other use case for demand response is, hey, let's communicate with whatever those devices are and say, hey, we see negative prices. Can you increase your load right now? Can you pre-cool your building? Can you increase your production for this period of time? So I think that's one of the use cases we see coming next as renewables continue to penetrate and we have overproduction in certain periods to help reduce the amount of curtailment that they have to live with.
Got it. So that's like a new element to the demand response solution that would help a client. Okay, that makes sense. So I guess in the end, back to another question I had. So demand response, if you wanted to invest in this sort of niche part of the market, where are the best places? Are there other software platforms? How do I think about the opportunity as an investor in demand response?
Yeah, so I don't know if you've heard the term virtual power plant. Some people are calling it demand response 3.0. It's not virtual, okay. It's just distributed assets. But it is part of the vernacular. DOE just came out with a report, one of their liftoff reports on, they called it virtual power plants. But essentially, the reason I raise that is because one of the major areas that allows, quote, load flexibility or behind the meter resources to grow is deploying more distributed assets, whether that's solar, whether that's batteries, whether that's thermal storage, or EV charging stations that have smart technology and software. All of that, if those are controllable, that means they're dispatchable, and we're able to trigger them to participate within the grid. So anybody who's working in software or hardware in those spaces, or project development or project finance, all of that needs to continue to grow. Actually, that's the more assets that are out there that are controllable, the more growth there is for demand response to participate. And then there's companies like InterSponse that are actually doing that market interface and interaction with the utilities and the grid operators.
So as the demand response capabilities grow, if I'm building a project that's solar and batteries or wind and solar and batteries, then I'd have a better chance of making more money into the market by using demand response because I'd be able to dispatch it at appropriate times.
Yeah, what we found is that the use case for most customers is that they don't need that product every day for that level of energy resilience. And so when those resources are not needed, then they can participate in the market.
Got it. Okay. That makes a lot of sense. So before we finish up, I kind of want to go back to something that you said earlier as we talked about the challenges of getting some of this new generation onto the grid. And you and I had spoke, offline before, and we talked about needing a little bit of, we'll call it permitting reform in terms of getting these projects to market, which I think it's going to take some time. So what do we do until then? Or better yet, what's the fastest to build and get approval with where we are today and get that online?
Yeah, so one of the biggest things in the industry is actually just upgrading our current transmission system. That can be relatively fast from a permitting perspective. More dynamic, or even on the permitting side itself, dynamic line ratings, how the utilities view the capacity of that line over certain times. Just that some policy changes within how we look at that within a utility could allow for more generation that's available now to be moved through the system for efficiency purposes. So that's one area. The other is
upgrading transmission is the first. Okay.
Yeah. The second, because we do need to move the energy that's currently being curtailed that's available to those load sites where we have pressure. So that does not require, a whole new buying of land or permitting or crossing state boundaries. That's just taking what we have right now and making it a little bit more efficient.
And how does that happen? Who invests in that though? Like who invests in the transmission upgrade? Is it the person who wants the new project? Is it the rate base? Is it like, why hasn't that happened already if we know all of this needs to be upgraded?
Yeah, so some of that has started and it's done by the transmission owner because they can get more throughput and so they get paid more. So that's the simplest. If it's within one state, one owner, where it clearly has a project that's being curtailed, that they can then get the line through. That's the easy case. Some of these are just adding some technology to their own system. That's relatively easy. When we talk about upgrading cross-state, cross-boundary lines, then yes, we're talking about FERC, and it gets more complicated, and then we need some reforms. So you asked your term, so I wasn't trying to go there. I was just talking about with the current lines that people own right now, that they can make the business case exist right now.
That makes sense.
The second is more demand response, though. I think there is not everywhere in the country has a program, and not everywhere has needed one. We haven't had some of these capacity constraints, but now we're finding news in co-ops that all of a sudden are doubling the size of their load because a new data center is coming in, or a new manufacturing plant, spurred by the CHIPS Act, for instance, is coming into their territory. They can try to build as fast as they can, but as we mentioned, permitting reform, citing NIMBYism, all the different combinations of why it's hard to build anything right now, no matter the technology of choice, getting the rest of your customers to participate in a program can help make room for that new asset.
Got it. Okay. So if everyone used demand response, would we still need more generation?
Yes, unfortunately, we aren't the only solution to the problem. I think the math from the annual FERC report shows that the capacity enrolled in programs between wholesale and retail is around 6% of peak load. But DOE is forecasting that we can easily get to 10 to 20%. So there's still a lot of room for us to impact the market. To provide those top hours, whether it's 20 or 100 hours a year of firm capacity to meet those peaks, whether it's summer or winter. That's another fascinating story around what's happening in some parts of the country around winter peaking. But unfortunately, we're not going to be able to handle that 4.7% load increase alone. We'll just help at the edge.
Got it. Just on the edges. Got it. Okay, that makes sense. We're getting here to the end, but there was just another thought that I'd had, and if the driver is these new data centers, right? And why doesn't tech just build their own power plants? Why are they using ours? Why are they sucking all our good power away from us and making it cost more? Do you think?
Yeah.
You think that ultimately this is a behind the meter solution for data centers, but it takes them, they're still trying to figure it out, or like what's a good strategy here that might work for others, all of us?
So I think it depends on where you sit in the ecosystem, because they need reliable power, no question. So being able to have some control over what's happening on site, whether that's solar and batteries and generators, as I mentioned. But right now, I think we're looking at their forecast as a doubling from about 10 gigawatts to 20 gigawatts of need. And so even for them, the amount of capital and permitting and all the challenges that utilities and other developers face, they're going to face as well. And then is that the most efficient thing for the system? I mean, if there is a generation, if building at scale makes sense, does it make sense to build a one-to-one relationship? And I have to give credit to a great podcast I listened to from the Carbon Copy that was talking specifically about this. So I really recommend people go listen to their data center and AI series that really focuses on the nexus with energy. I'm not convinced that microgrids for every data center is the best solution for all of us from a capital deployment standpoint.
So like the answer to all good questions, it depends. depending on where you are, what you're gonna do. No, I understand. That makes sense. I mean, I think it's a complicated challenge that we're facing today with many different stakeholders, not just the consumers of the power, but the environmental and policy, and so many different impacts that really I don't think folks have paid too very much attention to for, like you said, some time since we really had big load growth. So this has been great. Well, look, I know we have a couple more questions that we want to get to, but we're at time. So I want to say thank you very much, Rachel, for being on today, and look forward to hearing more about demand response and response in the future. So thank you.
Thank you.